nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology.
Right, good afternoon. So I'm going to talk to you about two different things today on roll-to-roll manufacturing of functional films. I was asked to give an overview of roll-to-roll manufacturing. So first, 40% of the slides are on just the basics of roll-to-roll manufacturing. Then I'm going to talk a little bit about functional films, specifically focused on what we do in Berg Nanotechnology Center. So, what is roll-to-roll manufacturing? A lot of people are asking that question, and this figure basically illustrates typically what a roll-to-roll manufacturing is. You're unwinding a roll of a medium, typically flat or patterned. Goes through a series of rolls, and you do a number of actions on it. And I'm going to talk about different actions that you can on it. And then finally immobilize them through either dryer or some sort of other fixing medium and before you pick it up. So thin flat film structures process continuously in the roll to roll. Why we're interested in this is because if you can do this continuously, the cost effectiveness is quite high, so you can make things a lot cheaper. So you're adding functional materials on top of a substrate that you have chosen, and there are a number of substrates that are available. So the history goes back to really 1800s. 1840, Richard Ho was the one who really started this printing application. Newspapers were the original roll-to-roll manufacturers from way back. So George Eastman, the founder of the Kodak Corporation, really picked up on this because at that time they were making photographic films on a paper. And his partner, Reichenbach, actually came up with this patent. The original roll-to-roll manufacturing is that's December 10, 1889. That so it went from on a paper to cellulose nitrate substrate. Those of you who are too young to remember, the old films, if they get caught in the motion picture machines, they tend to catch fire because this is cellulose nitrate is very flammable. If it stands still in front of a highly focused light beam, it just literally catches fire. Nowadays, they're using polyester, but in those days, for a very long time in the 20th century, cellulose nitrate was the king because it was high quality, very transparent, and you can deposit things on it very easily. So the traditional was the printing. Paper consumables are quite common in for printing applications, and then photography. And the photography is by no means is a simple structure. You can have as many as 24-layer deposition onto a photographic film. And so for many decades, this was the king for applications, either small format or large format films, until these digital versions of it started dominating the market in photography. So more recently, so the technology has evolved, especially to focus on printing and then printing the newspapers or paper consumables, marketing, etc. And then more recently, this whole technology was rediscovered by these functional people, microelectronics, display, photovoltaics, and batteries, and so on. And so the people have demonstrated photovoltaics that are flexible, the printed electronics that are really taking off nowadays. And then associated with that, they want to build the batteries as a result. So same needs. You need to do patterning. You need to be able to deposit. You need to immobilize it. And you need to make sure that they function as part of this whole process. So this is just a slew of applications area. And the batteries, as I said, alternative energy, they are using it for fuel cell membranes, for medical applications. Dermal patches, there's an enormous amount of market that uses oral-to-oral manufacturing. Information storage, still very actively the information stored on a magnetic tapes, especially for storage of large amount of information in the internet. And the printed electronics, this last but not the least, is the one that is potentially is going to take off quite significantly in the near future. So what are the functional materials? There are a number of materials that are out there that functionalize the substrates. These are can be chemically sensitized layers for photography. They could be. It's not switching quickly enough. I'm too far away, or the battery is running out. Ink used for printing lines, conductive, semiconducting, and dielectric, especially useful for flexible electronics area. And that an optical applications that has been quite active for almost at least 3-4 decades for applications involving liquid crystal displays that are still quite common and on optical films. And this is also for functional materials. Photovoltaics that are literally coming up, for, particularly for flexible solar cell applications that are commonly used. And then and the, one of the areas that are very actively sought after nowadays is the barrier layers. So many of these functional materials are environmentally sensitive. So they want to protect them from oxygen and the moisture because many of these materials, for example, semiconducting materials and conductive materials, especially organic versions of these, they tend to have a conjugated bonds that are very sensitive and then so they get influenced by the environment. You have to protect them using these barrier layers. So the creation of the barrier layers in the roll-to-roll fashion is also an important need right now. Magnetic layers, for example, magnetic tape applications. Okay. So they can be patterned. They can be patterned, of course, using a standard printing methods, inkjet printing, flexography, and screen printing. I'll show you some example. There are a very large number of them, so I'm not going to go over them and just give you highlights of what they are. And so the people tend to choose one over the other depending on the application, and there's always pros and cons associated with the each individual a patterning method within the 1 hour allotted to me. I cannot go into any of those details, but I'll just briefly touch on those. So they can be patterned using inkjet printing, flexography, and screen printing, as you see there. And there are other areas where you can actually do patterning on the surfaces using technologies like photolithography or embossing, hot embossing, or UV system. Particularly for creating pattern surfaces for liquid crystal displays and also special fluid management systems like microfluidics, particularly useful for medical applications. And so there is these two were the top-down processes. You actually have some sort of a macro molding system that you can actually use to create the patterns. The last one is called the bottom-up approach where phase separation of block copolymers can create micro patterns. And so this technology also is, in a very minor way, is being used by IBM, for example, for memory storage. There are other areas, other layers that you have to use in the roll-to-roll manufacturing. These are called ancillary layers. These ancillary layers are very important for functional performance of these devices. These could be adhesion-promoting layers. This is one of the most important layers that people consider because when you're doing these flexible medium, you tend to have these flexibility and it comes with it potential for a delamination of the coated layers. So adhesion-promoting layers are very important consideration there. Anti-static layers are also important for function, especially if you have electronics that are sensitized in the on the substrates, and then the protective layers to protect the functional layers from environment and mechanical damage. And these are, as I said, one is the barrier layers as well as the mechanical performance. Slip layers are also important for to minimize friction during the transportation of the roll-to-roll, that the people actually use these slip layers to make sure that there's not a high enough friction to cause damage to these materials. There's a lot of these little details to make actually these functional materials work in a roll-to-roll environment. So, as I said, the barrier layers is also an important one. Substrate is the most critical part of the whole roll-to-roll manufacturing. It basically supports all of the functional layers, and they must be mechanically very strong. And because most of the functional layers that you use, they tend to be small molecule, and they are not mechanically very sturdy. And so the job for sturdiness is basically left to the substrate. And they must be generally, dimensionally and mechanically, environmentally very stable throughout the lifetime of the product. So it basically protects the function. So the key parameters are mechanical stiffness, thermal properties, glass transition and melting point in case of polymers, and optical properties, optical transmittance, and birefringence, which is the optical anisotropy. Potential substrates could be as I said, paper, metallic, and polymers. And more recently, as I found in a more recent meeting, they actually start making flexible ceramics. Although they are extremely expensive, you can actually use flexible ceramic nowadays. And there are flexible glass that's out there that people use, willow glass and gorilla glass, that can be used in a roll-to-roll operation with some limited specifications. For example, flexible glass, the smallest bending radius is not very, very small compared to plastic films, which is 4 centimeter, or stainless steel, 4 centimeter. In the case of flexible glass, you're looking at about 40 centimeter. You cannot bend it into a small curl, but you can still make it. There is one of the important parameters that people worry about, the coefficient of thermal expansion, because the layers that you put, functional layers, that you put on top of a material has to reasonably match with the substrate. And if there is temperature variations in throughout the life cycle of the device, then these mismatch of coefficient of thermal expansion can lead to delamination issues and function loss as a result of that. So you have a breadth of plastic films. This is just a generic classification. There's a range of those that are available. And obviously stainless steel as well as flexible glass, although flexible glass tend to be rather expensive side, although they can take significantly higher temperatures, as you can see. So the maximum processing temperature becomes an important issue, especially when you're doing a vacuum deposition, high temperature deposition, that the plastic films cannot take. The stiffness-wise, obviously, the stainless steel is very high, although some polymers are catching up to it recently. So, general operation. This the figure on the right, upper right, is basically describes roughly the unit operations of a roll-to-roll process. You're looking at an unwinding section, and then a whole series of processing, S1 through 5, is just a hypothetical one. And these are film-forming steps. You typically form thin film onto the substrate, wet coating, vacuum deposition, printing, solvent casting, and extrusion casting. A number of techniques, a large number of them are available. And film enhancement steps. These include consolidation, modify, and improve the performance of the deposit layers. These are including drying, radiation curing, thermal curing, and micro and nano patterning, heat treatment, annealing, and etc. And all of these are to basically to help improve the what you have deposited on it. And there might be special environments they needed. Could be temperature, humidity, and vacuum. And most of the people they nowadays in roll-to-roll manufacturing are trying to get away from the vacuum deposition systems because they tend to be costly. But if you have to, people build machines like Applied Materials that can do this whole roll-to-roll process in a high vacuum. So in general operation, the line spin is very sort of a critical. The final line speed is constrained by the slowest processing step. Okay, you cannot go faster than the slowest processing step. As a result, and if there is an uneven unit operations that are going on, then what dictates is the slowest processing step. If not, you might have to split the process into multiple processes, roll-to-roll processes, one running faster, the other one is running slower, or you do it in a multiple runs. You run once, and then you go back and do it slower, and so on. And line tension is also one of the most important things to consider for the roll-to-roll operation. It's controlled throughout the line. It's because you're dealing with a flexible substrate, either glass, polymer, or steel. There is a potential for wrinkling and all kind of problems associated with that. The control of the line tension in these machines are absolutely critical. Otherwise, you can have all kind of problems in the product that you try to produce. Believe it or not, storage is a huge issue. Because you're winding up into a roll, the curl, and then the most of these devices are kept in the roll state for a very extended period in the storage. Curl or permanent set of the film, especially for polymers, is an important one. So you can have a curl. When you open it up, it still remains curly. And if you want to try to use it flat. So this could be an issue. And core damage. And if you look at the geometry of these rolls that you're picking up, the inner side of the cores, they are typically, in our machines, are typically about 3-inch wide. So the films or the products that are deposited closer to the core have a different environment than the products that is at the outer edges of this roll. And so when you use high stresses, you generate much higher stresses in the core than in the outer edges. And that can actually literally damage the product that you put on, because it literally gets sandwiched in the process. So if you use a high tension, it damages. If you use a low tension, in telescoping, those of us who've used photographic films would know what telescoping is. If you let it go, it just opens up, unfurls itself very quickly. Blocking is an important consideration for these kind of applications. Blocking means basically adhesion of the product to the previously back of the previously deposited rolled the film. And so in the worst case scenario, you can actually add in an interleaving layer, some layer in between, so that you prevent this adhesion to occur, or you modify the product. So let me slowly get into the science of all these things. Coating is basically involved multiple steps: solution preparation, mixing hardware, and mixing technique. There are a very large number of techniques that are available out there for solution mixing. The key parameters to consider is the viscosity of the solution and the surface tension. Surface tension is absolutely critical, especially when you're trying to do a free surface deposition onto a carrier. So that's very important. There are a number of coating methods, slot die, Dr. Blade, gravure, etc. There's very large number of them, about 30 or 40 of them out there. And one of the important steps is the drying and the solidification, either drying by evaporation of the solvent that might remain, or solidification as a result of cooling, if it's a melt extrusion, or solidification as a result of some sort of a radiative effects, UV, X-rays, and so on. And so one of the most important things to consider is the defect generation, and understand the fundamental causes of the defects and mechanisms of the defects so that you can address them. And they can be issue, especially when you're dealing with a relatively low viscosity materials that you're depositing onto the substrates that are moving at fairly good clip. Typical solution mixers, here's an example, Carl's blade mixers. These are for more industrial size. You basically have a bucket with fast-moving devices. The key points here is that there are two issues that you have to consider. Macro mixing, basically long-range concentration gradients are eliminated, and the micro mixing is that the local concentration gradients are eliminated because of the fact that many of these materials involve some sort of a binder polymer. They tend to be viscoelastic, and then you have issues related to mixing in the process. So the choice of mixers are important. We have in Burke is a Tinky mixer. It's a intensive mixer that basically you basically get a cup and that rotates about its axis, and then also it rotates like a centrifuge and then creates a double rotation, and the material experience is about 250 to 300 G's in this cup, together with the media, typically ceramic, that helps the break up the particles into a solution. So there are other ones such as Ross mixer and lightning mixer. These are much larger scale operations. Tinky machines, they've also scaled up these machines. They can actually make these solutions in a fairly large tanks on the order of multiple gallons today. One of the most important things to consider is the surface interaction between liquid and a contact surface. Contact angle is an important consideration in depositing the liquids onto a substrate. Whether the liquid that you're depositing wets or not makes a big difference in terms of uniformity of the film and its drying behavior or solidification behavior, whether it's a solvent or solventless systems. So you typically use a contact angle measurement systems to determine the surface energy of the material. And also one of the important things to consider is also the not only just simply contact angle, but also the polar and nonpolar parts, as well as the hydrogen bonding aspects of the wetting these functions. These are much more detailed analysis of what kind of a liquid that you're depositing onto a substrate. And there is another issue of hysteresis, that is the advancing contact angle versus receding contact angle. These are very important considerations, especially when you have a non-uniform, non-homogeneous, surfaces that the that tends to cause this hysteresis behavior, and then this can derive all kind of coating issues. So printing and coating techniques, some of these are we have gravure printing in Burke. Flexography printing typically used in the printing industry, and screen printing we have a batch process, although it can be done in a continuous operation. Here is a continuous screen printing technique. Basically, you have a liquid that has a squeegee inside this drum, and basically allow the material to pass through in the areas where you want to deposit it onto a carrier. The screen printing, they tend to make thicker films. Gravure printing is much finer resolution. Here's a table of comparison between them. So screen printing, and here and applications. This was taken from a Department of Energy study at some point. So rotary screen printers are quite effectively used in the roll-to-roll manufacturing. Inkjet printing is also commonly used. And there are some resolution issues, as you can see, that the gravure is still some of the best. You can go down to about 17 nanometer features with the gravure. And the screen printing is sort of in between. And you also can do other things like flexography and laser photoablation with a laser removal of the materials in the process. I'm going to skip this one, but there is a detailed comparison of these devices. Okay, let me switch gears to the second half of the presentation, is roll-to-roll manufacturing of functional films. I'm going to talk about three different things, mainly focused on what is the really needed for the flexible electronics industry that's coming up in the next decade or so. The first requirement that we identified is that you really need, if you want to make a flexible electronic device, you have to have a flexible electrode. If you're going to make a flexible electronic device, you also need to have flexibility, stretchability, bendability, and in some cases, transparency, especially if you're dealing with displays. So all of these devices, they need multifunction in it. So the substrates that we talked about are basically dumb. They just simply carry all of the functional materials on it, whether it's a polymer, typically polyester, PET is used, or PEN is used, or non-polymer systems that we talked about. But in this case, you may have to change the flip the whole thing and then start using functionality in the substrates themselves. So I'm going to tell you about how do you functionalize the substrates using this technologies and making these flexible electrodes. Here's the process that there are a number of concepts that are out there. People deposit conductive nanowires onto the surface and then create a layer of conductive layer on the substrates. One of the bigger issues in such systems is that you always have an interface between the conductive layer and the substrate. And this is, and if you don't have a good adhesion between them, any kind of bending and stretching and so on causes a delamination. So to address that, here is the technology that we developed. You basically use electrospinning to create a very small conductive nanowires. So these, and at the same time, you take the precursor material to the substrate in liquid state. So you go one step back. Instead of making the solid, you actually start with a liquid precursor onto a carrier. You literally deposit the nanofibers and they actually get buried partially onto the surface. So the whole idea is so that, you eliminate that potentially damaging interface that can delaminate subsequently. So the other benefit of such a structure is that you can, by embedding the nanofibers that are about 200 nanometer in size, and I'll show you how it's processed, how it's made, that you also can do a refractive index matching that can give you transparency. So you eliminate the potential for breakage, and you have a continuous nanofibers that are inside the material, and then subsequently you just basically solidify it and you trap the material inside. So electrospinning, for those of you who are not familiar with, is basically a very simple process. You have a liquid that is going through the nozzle, and then you create a potential between the target and the nozzle, and the liquid that is coming out basically charged, and the charges basically repel each other, and that causes this accelerated creation of the fibers while the solvent that you use rapidly evaporates because your surface is rapidly expands and creates such fibers. And you get these kind of fibers on the order of, if you don't work very hard, you typically make about 200 to 300 nanometer. If you work hard, you can go down to about 50 nanometer or less on creating these essentially randomly oriented structures. The one negative on this one is that you create this randomly oriented nanofibers. People tended to put a little target with a cylinder with a high-speed rotator to get them to orient. People have done that, but it's not necessarily a very continuous operation. So this is the machine, roll-to-roll machine that we built, and it's in a clean room in the Berg Nanotechnology Center. It has a multifunctions, and I'm going to focus only on the first part of the machine. You can actually cast a solution using a doctor blade onto a substrate. And then there is a series of nozzles. As you can see, the white nozzles here, there are about 9 of these. One of the negatives on the electrospinning is that the mass throughput is not very high. You're making 200 nanometer from a single nozzle. So the only way you can make it commercially available, you need to have thousands of these on a line so that they can make a whole bunch of nanofibers in the process. So people have actually done that. Million nozzles, they do it, all kind of techniques that are available right now. So the process is continuous. You can actually, substrate is in a liquid state as it's going underneath these nozzles, and you deliver the nanofiber. Here's a video from one of my previous machines. It's a single nozzle. You're depositing, this is a precursor to, believe it or not, Kapton. It starts as a liquid like that. So the material remains in liquid. It's on a conductive polyethylene substrate. So it acts as an electrode, sort of a ground for electrode spinning. And you have, this is the nozzle, and you're looking at generation of the nanofibers. What you're looking at is sort of a deceiving. It looks like a multiple fibers. Actually, a single fiber is whipping. So it's a whipping action. And then it enters into the solution as a result. By just simply rasterizing it, you can deposit it onto the surface. A number of tools that we have to control. You can control the viscosity of the liquid so that if you keep it high, the fibers remain near the surface. If you don't keep it high, actually you can penetrate deep into the material, creating basically a nanofiber, basically a network structure. So the whole idea is that, for those of you who are familiar with the percolation concept, is that we basically satisfy the percolation within the fibers. This is the percolation of a P.PSS. It's a conductive material within the fiber, and these fibers themselves basically form a continuous network in the material. Typically, we have also built special tools such as this device that actually can do all kind of flexing, stretching, and bending applications to transparent conductive materials, and while measuring the electrical conductivity. And this is an illustration of what a typical indium tin oxide coated PET that is over a certain diameter undergoing cyclic bending. As you can see, as you change the diameter of the device, at some point the material basically cracks and then resistivity goes up. The material that we made, fiber embedded films, they just remain at that conductivity level. And if you take this and then fold it and crease it, and still do not lose the conductivity. This is the folding. This is the worst thing you can do actually to an electrode. Literally folding and creasing it. And so it's very robust system. I'll skip that one. So we're using that transparent electrode with the help of a Kent State University Liquid Crystal Institute. We made this little smart film. Here's a video of it that can switch. It's a very small curvature device. And this, by the way, was the first time we ever tried and it worked. So it was nice to see that. So let me talk a little bit about the basics of coating and drying complexities. So in order to, this is a very important. We're going from a liquid state to a solid state in the process. So we really must understand fundamental chemistry and physics. And so in order to address that, we actually built this tool called Joey. The tool is basically looks like a wind tunnel. And the whole idea is to basically create a section of a roll-to-roll machine in a well-controlled environment. In this case, we have on the right air blower, basically a sophisticated hair dryer, that we control temperature and then airspeed going through these very small tubes so that it's highly controlled. There's not much turbulence going on there coming out. Onto a platform which is made of graphite. So it's very highly thermally conductive. And then it sits on a balance, electronic balance. So we monitor the weight of the solution that is cast onto a substrate, typically either glass or polymer. And we do all kind of measurements, either the weight changes, thickness changes using laser micrometers that are over here. These are Keyence laser micrometers that monitors the thickness of the liquid itself, and then at the same time measure in-plane and out-of-plane birefringence. It's a measure of optical anisotropy of the material. And it's important, especially in the case of polymers. So we do casting onto a substrate, and we also monitor the temperature and the thickness. Here's a typical data. Weight changes and thickness changes almost goes in parallel with each other. And there's the temperature measurement. This blue line is the out-of-plane birefringence. In-plane birefringence remains flat. But out-of-plane birefringence takes off at some critical drying behavior. So the material, a polymer in this particular case, is a long-chain molecule. And polymers inherently optically anisotropic. If they are in a solution, they are like a balls, and so they are isotropic. That's why the birefringence is essentially zero at the beginning. But at some point, they lose solvent, and then that ball that initially start, it turns into a pancake or disc. And when it happens, disc, if you look from the top, disc still a circle and optically isotropic. But if you look at it at an oblique angle, it's anisotropic. And that's the difference between the two measurements here. So that the fact that it goes from sphere to non-sphere condition, we can actually pick it up in this condition. By the way, this particular phenomenon is commonly used in liquid crystal television screens as a top layer for looking at enhancing the viewing angle from an oblique angle perspective, because colors tend to be washed from an oblique angle. So this is illustrated in next slide. That is gonna take a little bit. Okay. Here's the top view. As the solution is drying and this thing is going, and here's the molecule, what it does. Top view and then side view. As soon as this turns into a pancake, you see the blue that is out of plane birefringence takes off. Here's another example, more sophisticated system where we do a multi-step processes. So you can literally simulate what happens in the process, because in one part of the process, you might have a room temperature and you can increase the temperatures in a series of times. And you can literally do that with this tool and find out what really happens in different parts of the process if you know residence time in each section. So this is a very useful tool for simulating exactly what happens to the material, physically what's going on in individual stages without having to follow it along the machine. Here's an example of what you can do. Percent solvent remaining in the material, you can extract from this. This is different temperatures, airflow temperatures in this case. Higher temperatures, obviously you lose the solvent faster, quicker. Here's the autoplane birefringence, basically how fast this pancaking occurs. Low temperatures, notice that it actually goes to a higher anisotropy compared to higher temperatures. As you can see, there's always crossover in here. Higher temperatures, you lose the solvent quickly, but the anisotropy you get is not as high. Not necessarily intuitive. Here's an example of a thickness effect, solution thickness. Smaller thicknesses, they tend to give you higher optical anisotropy than the larger thicknesses, because they tend to relax more as a result of it. So these are the kind of things that you can actually do using this tool in order to really understand what's happening in the process. You can do this. We've been doing it for polymer solutions, but you can also do it for other things like inks or other inorganic materials. How do they undergo from liquid to solid state? And people really don't pay attention to it. And particularly when it comes to the problems associated with their function, and then some of these physics and chemistry buried in there can be identified using this real-time monitoring systems like these. So let me switch over to some other issues related to coding, defects. There are all kinds of defects. There are huge. There are books on the defect generation in coding. So I'm going to just simply two snippets. For example, defects caused by feed preparation, non-uniformity of concentration, roll coating, ribbing and streaks and chatter in the process, die design, the uniformity of the web, these are all related to all manufacturability, surface tension related and convection, so-called Benard instabilities, static electricity can be an important issue, and drying related issues such as skin formation. Those of us who had any kind of cuts and you have blood basically dries from the top, forms a skin, it literally happens in these solutions. If you have a skin formation and that skin traps the solvents on the inside of the material, essentially become an impermeable barrier. And that creates all kind of issues, such as bubble formation as the solvent basically leaves and creating a porous structure in the structure. So it's very critical to really understand the process of drying associated with the roll-to-roll processing. Here's an example of what can go wrong. Here's what they call in the industry orange peel. It looks like an orange peel that's associated with this so-called skin formation related instability. This is very famous in the physics world, so-called Rayleigh-Benard and Benard-Marangoni instability. It's basically when you have a hot surface underneath, when you're heating it up, you can create a convective flow, and then it gives you these kind of interesting patterns in the surfaces. So you cannot push the process as fast. You can't have a very high temperature one side, very low temperature one side. It doesn't like it. So you really need to understand and then try to address that issue. So one of the things that we've been focusing on is that in a normal conventional processing operations, when you put in functional materials, most polymers don't have function. They are basically dielectrics, except very few cases nowadays there they have some conductivities associated with that. In order to make them functional, we add things to it, either small molecules such as nanoparticles, metals, ceramics, and so on, and to functionalize it. So many a year we've been doing that in the polymer industry, but we are subjected to what happens to them in the actual processing operations. If you try to make a fiber, you tend to pull on it, and these particles, they go along with the fiber. And if you make a film, the same story, that they go along with the film forces. So if you're trying to make materials such as this, a membrane for a fuel cell that is organized, all these particles in the thickness direction, you can't do it with a traditional melt processing operation. There are many other applications that need such a case, magnetic field alignment. You want to align the magnetic particles in thickness direction on a thin film. Filters, photovoltaics, you want to create structures that are doing this, PN structures that are vertical, so interdigitized structures. So so we built, this is the second generation machine that we built in Purdue. You can apply electric field or magnetic field, depending on the material that you're interested to get them organized within the solution prior to the solution, the matrix becoming solid. Hence, this particular roll-to-roll process. I talked about the first part where there's an electrospinning system. There's also electrical field application zone, as well as the magnet. Here is a 2.7 Tesla magnet on the machine. So it's like a switchblade. You can actually use one, two, or three of these options on this machine. It's 40 foot long. So I'll tell you a little bit about what you can do with it. With the electric field, you can literally take, for example, block copolymers and organize them in thickness direction, one of the blocks. The key driving force is the dielectric contrast between the phases. If you have a sufficiently large difference in the dielectric constants of the two phases, the critical voltage for alignment goes down. One of the problems with the electric field is that you cannot go indefinitely high because at some point it's going to break down. So you have to operate at the temperature, at the voltage levels where that break, you're far away, you're safely far away from it so that you can actively use it. So the other thing is this so-called Clausius-Mazotti, the equation gives you the contrast. The other parameter that helps you on the alignment is the size of the particles. Large particles tend to polarize much more readily. What's countering these forces is the thermal fluctuations. That's in the numerator. This lambda parameter, if it's greater than one, would actually get alignments something like this. These are micro bubbles in a photocurable resin in electric field. That basically form these chains of particles, and while it's creating these depletion zones between them. So if these particles have functions such as electrical or thermal conductivity, you can enhance it in thickness direction while creating pathways for the light to pass through. So at the same time, because you have a pathways, and you also have a maintenance of the material's mechanical properties, most polymers are relatively flexible and so on. So you achieve the flexibility, transparency, and also functionality in the thickness direction. It's illustrated something like this. The particles, whoops, went too fast. Anyway, you got the whole idea. The particles polarize and positive attracts the negative. Let me give you some examples. Clay particles in the electric field. Clays are, these are Montmorillonite type clays. They tend to be very flat. And we wanted to orient, especially the flat molecules are very hard for polymer engineers to orient in the direction other than in the plane. Because if you put it into a flow, they always go in the flow direction. And we wanted to orient them in the thickness direction. So this tool that we have, we can also use it to apply electric field using a transparent electrodes. And so we did that. And here's an example of without any particles, the resin itself doesn't get affected by the electric field. We turn it on here. This is the optical anisotropy measure, both 0 and 45 degree birefringence. Whereas when you put a clay, as soon as you turn on the electric field, the outer plane changes rapidly and very fast. You can actually follow it in optically. Here is an optical microscopy in cross polars. What you see here is the yellows and blues. What they indicate optically is that yellows are pointing in one direction and then blues are pointing in the other direction. They're almost 90 degrees to each other. Look what happens when I turn on the electric field. All the yellows turn into blue. They're all pointing in the same direction. And it happens very fast. So you can get them to organize. In this particular case, where the field was in the 45 degree direction, if you enhance the image, and what you see is that you form these columns also of clays, because they're all forming these blue orientations in this optical arrangement. And you can measure the birefringence. Here's a birefringence is a very good measure of how these particles get organized, and then you can see beyond about 120 or 200 volts per millimeter, the whole process is almost instantaneous, and it happens immediately, and all the particles point in that direction very quickly. And you can verify with the X-ray diffraction. Here is a no voltage application. This is the clay 001 peak. And then when you orient them, they get oriented in the in all directions. And this is the order parameter that gives us how far away from the perfection, which is 0.5. We're not too far away from it. So all these clays are basically pointing straight up and down in the thickness. Why am I interested in clay orientation on this? This is also potentially good for ionic conduction. Clays can conduct ionically very effectively in such films. Just to illustrate, we actually demonstrated this whole process using our earlier machine, using a UV curing system. Here's a roll of film that we made with clays that are all pointing in the normal to the film surface. And it's verified by X-ray diffraction, just number of places that we have done. More recently, we actually took there's another kind of clays that are basically like a scrolls. And these clays also get very oriented. And if you pay close attention to the X-rays, they are so sharp. You can see the X-ray patterns at near perfect orientation. Literally, all these cylinders are pointing straight up. These are called halocyte nanoclays. They are very effectively oriented. Same measurements. Other things, barium titanate has a very high dielectric constant. Here's SEM pictures of unoriented material. And then here's with the field-oriented materials in close-up, you can actually see zoom in. You can see only an electron microscope, you can actually see the chains on the... The benefit of this is that if you do a dielectric constant, especially for capacitor applications, here's exact same concentration, 10% barium titanate. Black is the randomly oriented particles, and the red is the oriented particles. And we're almost doubling the dielectric constant in thickness direction by just simply organizing these columns. Other things that you can do, this is one of the important areas that I think is going to be beneficial for flexible electronics, is compliance matching between the different layers. As I mentioned, is that if you have a dielectric, the coefficient of thermal expansion mismatch between the layers, then you have a problem of delamination or creating stresses between the layers. For example, if you apply DC field instead of AC field, you can literally create a gradient of particles inside the film. Here's top surface is basically populated by barium titanate, and the bottom surface is not much. If you look at a micro X-ray tomography, you can see that gradient. Yellow is basically barium titanate particles. And then by changing the electrical conditions, you can spread the gradient or making it very sharp as a result. And that also helps in controlling this gradient in very thin films on the order of 100 microns. Well, other things I'll just briefly show you. A lot of people ask me, what do you do with the carbon nanotubes? Well, here's a carbon nanotube in electric field. You can do the same thing. It's look at the bottom of the video. You form, at the beginning, you don't see anything because they are so small, it's not visible. When they agglomerate into form columns, and you actually start seeing them. And they form very nice continuous columns throughout the, and the electric field, by the way, is in the vertical direction. And you can effectively create these extended formation of these structures. The interesting instability is that theoreticians are going to be having a ball with it. As you can see, that gets ripened structure, but you never lose that connected network with the carbon nanotubes. So I can go on, but what do you think? There's the piezoelectric aspects and so on. This is the work of Armen sitting in the audience. The whole idea is that we're trying to create a piezoelectric material using a PZT in a PDMS matrix. There are many, many applications for this. One of them is basically nanogenerators to create energy out of motion of the moving bodies, whether it's a human body or other kind of machines that are vibrating, to essentially harvesting it, and so on. So the same thing, electric field application of PZT materials in a PDMS, which is a precursor. So I showed you enough of these videos, and I'll show you the quickly towards the end. You can see that it gets lighter and lighter as you get them organized. So light transmits more readily. See, the early stages is pretty dark. And when you organize them, you have all these pathways for the light to pass through the material. And you form these very long columns of piezoelectric material. The benefit is that you get this extremely oriented columns that you form in the process. We've also added a few things like graphite nanoparticles that help create more, nucleate more columns locally. Here's a graphite particle with the additional sort of a tips, create nucleate additional columns at the top, following the field lines near the conductive particle. And you can see the micro CT it's near perfect orientation. Here's a illustration of a video of a small droplet, 5 microliters of water dropping onto the sensor, force sensor, and you can actually measure it. This an oscilloscope picks up. This is 30 microliters, 30 milligrams basically. It's still very small. We basically overscale the whatever that scale. What was the scale? Yeah, 300 millivolts. So Armen did all kind of measurements. You can see the measurement voltage versus pressure at different initial electrical field applications so that if you use a higher voltage, you get more organized columns. And the result is you get a higher voltage generation when you apply a certain weight from a distance. And this weight is converted to pressure, simple relationship. So So people actually do a finger tap just to see how the material can respond to it. This is actually published literature in Nanoletters with a finger tap, and you're looking at about 0.2 to 0.3 volts. With our system, with the same kind of finger tap, is 8.2 volts, about 20 times higher voltage output on this device. So it's promising for nanogenerators. So Armen actually went one step further, and he put a sort of a feather on top of a sensor, and you can actually literally measure that feather that was 1.4 milligrams. And it's able to detect it. So we have an ultra sensitivity, so we can literally back off on putting the materials in. That means PZTs tend to be more costly, polymers are less costly, so you can still create all kind of force sensors for lesser sensitivity using this system. He also did sort of a matrix. Because of the beauty of the structure, these columns are independent of each other. They are separated by dielectrics. So if you have electrodes on printed on either side, you can literally have these individual piezo columns separately, very close to each other. So he actually did that. And you can see, it's hard to see that, but here's the digitized image, and here's a blown up view of the single tab. And you can see the pressure distribution under the fingertip. And you can see the response time is extremely fast, typical of piezoelectric materials. And we made them into long columns using this roll-to-roll machine. It's also transparent. And you can see here. And I think I should stop it right here. All right. Thank you.